the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. It's many miles from where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest. Pound to me, take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
Is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champagne 90.1 on your FM dial.
Dave on the board. Today is September the 17th, 2017. And this is
Do
Dave.
We have guests today? Susan Taylor and Cope Compson. And we'll get back to that in a moment. I have a little bit of reporting to do. Liz Kirby has been up there at Rantoul taking out teasels. And that's very, very helpful. The other morning she got 147 teasels. We've been up there with 6-hour days trying to do the same, and we've been working at it for 6 years. So we're almost eliminated that invasive species. At Seymour, I had a shamrock club come. They're independently home teaching group, age groups from perhaps 5 to 13 or 14, and they pick prairie seed, and then they picked reed canary grass, which is an invasive weed, and we packed it up in a bags, and I have to find out somewhere to incinerate that, because we just don't want the seeds around. The gay pride parade was on. I just walked back with one person, and we discussed that how wonderful it was to actually be able to walk around the streets occasionally. And we had Eleonora, the guitar festival, and I didn't get a chance to go. I had a lot of other things going, but I have gone in the past. One of the interesting things I remember there was that there was a woman guitarist. She was an engineer, and she had responded to a request for a guitar player. And when she called up, the agency said, "But women don't play guitar." End of conversation. And she was there, and she was a riot, and said something about women being able to play guitar. And in WEF sessions, we often have women playing guitar. I was at the farmer's market and ran into backyard gardening people, some of whom had worked with me. And we do hope that people will put in their lawn sometimes into green. And then I ran into a couple that were doing things with standard. Standardization, person that was most concerned was a German person who is aware that there is a standard in Paris, and he has some realization that we have to be careful about those items. The videographer who was interviewing people was Eurasian. Her mother was Chinese, and father was from Chicago and or Caucasian. And mother had gotten here because when the Chinese people split off Taiwan, men were sent to the U.S. For higher learning, but there weren't any women, and they decided to send two women, and she was one of them. And she, the daughter who I was speaking to, was born in Mississippi and came to Chinatown and then to Urbana, and she, in a few minutes, had an interesting story to tell. And this is what we're talking about, is storytelling. And so just you should communicate with each other. Just talk as you're going along the street, as I did coming back from the gay parade. So we're talking about a publication that Susan and Cope have been jointly involved in. And it's about Homestead Farm on Long Island. And it starts off with history in the 1600s and moves through. I want to introduce these two people, but then I want them to pick up. Cope has also done a publication on her late husband, Walter, whom a lot of you know. Cope has been Cope and Walter have been storytellers and a lot of other things at Weft, including board and other involvement. So, first of all, Susan grew up on Long Island. She's also come to the Midwest and has for years taught English as a second language. I want to say that she's been on the Heartland Pathways board and in background boards of various description. And a few people know it, but there were three of us that decided whether we should take out a surface transportation board interim trail use for the Kickapoo Trail. And Susan is very much in there. She was one of the two of us. There were three of us. And we had an objection because there's always the question of whether you should develop what you already have instead of doing more to obtain more. But the risk is that the more you might want will never be available again. So you have to do it while you're thinking about it. So Susan has been in there, and she's been involved in a lot of other things. Cope has been around a lot. She is not only a WEF person, but she's been on the school board. She's just returned from her daughter's wedding. And so they've been working together on a book that was started by John Taylor. And he had a lot of help from grandfather, who kept photographs and talked to the community. This was an extended family and extended workers and a community of agriculture. And it started to get developed from the New York side of things. So, Susan, say something about where you grew up.
Dave has opened the door for Cope and me to say most anything, so here I go. I hope you can hear me. I have a kind of a cracky voice sometimes. Dave has mentioned our grandfather, and I think I need to start there if I'm talking about the book. And I don't know whether Dave's held up the book sufficiently for you to see that it's there for those of you who see this program as well as hear it. Grandfather was born in 17... No, he wasn't. He was born in 1854, 52. And his wife, my grandmother, was born in 1854. So I'm a living relic, I think, of three centuries, not only the 19th, but the 20th, and Brother John and I into the 21st, much to our mutual surprise. John was born in 1926, the middle of seven children. We had quite a range. Our oldest sister was 18 years older, 17 and a half older than I. And there were 4 years in between many of them. And then mother had four children in 3 years. And then grandmother threw up her hands in horror when she heard there was another one coming, and that's I. And I made it, but I was the only one of the seven born in a hospital, and that was in Manhattan in New York City, because grandmother and grandfather had moved from Boston to New York, because grandfather found that New York was more active business-wise than Boston was. And he commuted rather regularly, on including holidays. It seems that New Yorkers had two holidays only a week apart, not only Christmas, but New Year's Day. So grandfather would get on the train on New Year's Day and go up to Boston and do a good day's work, because he couldn't do anything in New York. He was in the cotton business. And now we see so many changes since grandfather was in the cotton business. And there are a lot of things in our family history that are really no-nos all the way back. I don't want to get into them too much, because this book focuses on the food that we all need now around the world. I'm very sensitive to that, not that I can do a whole lot about it, but we grew up on this farm that grandfather said was needed 30 miles from New York City, because all the food that anybody in his next generation had to eat if they came out to get away from Manhattan, which grandfather was glad to do too. They weren't crazy about Manhattan, so his offspring, and mother's oldest brother was just the same age as my dad, who was 10 years older than mother. But anyway, back to grandfather. He lost his eyesight, and he was an editor. So he edited the New England poets before he got into cotton business. And when he was a little boy, because he had this handicap of eyesight, he thought he would never, never be like his five older sisters, who were all very literate and very much writing to each other every day as they grew up. And those letters, I'm wandering off the topic of Homestead Farm as usual, but those letters that those sisters who were born in the 1850s, 60s, and of whom I only knew two, I guess, got to be in their 90s, and did lots of interesting, very interesting things besides writing to each other every day and passing the letters around, sort of round robin, I think. And they are now stored in the, I have to get the right word, Radcliffe Women's History Library. Radcliffe is no longer part of Harvard University as it was maybe 25 years ago. I've lost track. I think it's more recent than that. But their name went off the college roster, and the niece of ours, who's recognized in the book, is a graduate of Radcliffe, so she's an editor kind of a person too. She does Native American books. Well, anyway, Sarah was not here in in Urbana. And I've been east to be with my brother John as he pulled this book together with the help of two Long Islanders. And then they were not available, and I was one of them. I came to Illinois, and I thought, oh, I'll never finish this book in Illinois, because John passed last summer after a couple of years of illness, which had very much two sides for me, more than two sides. It had one very strong side. I hadn't seen him. I've been in Illinois for 50 years now, and I would go back and forth to Homestead Farm when Mother was still living, but she died in 83. So I got to know my brother and what he'd been doing, and one of the things he'd been doing was keeping meticulous records of the birds that he worked on, which was one of his major interests. And he never left Cold Spring Harbor, Long Island, New York. And that is what tied me back to Long Island, was getting back to see John when he was in illness and in recuperation and rehab for a couple of years, and celebrated his 90th birthday before he passed. And that outlived Grandfather, it outlived Dad, it lived, outlived my brother Ben, who was younger, and so forth. So anyway, there's a couple of us left now, one in New Hampshire, twin, and myself. So back to Cope.
So if you could give us a rundown of what you've been doing with Walters.
Well, I spent my career working as a book designer, which comes in very handy when it when it's time to do these kinds of personal projects. And so I know about taking a manuscript and figuring out what shape it ought to be, and what, how to use photographs, and then how to design a cover. That's what I retired from at the University of Illinois Press. And so I have done many books for friends around town, people who have something to say, but it's cumbersome and often not the best way to do it, to go through a professional publishing company. And so when you have something personal and you want to get it out there, there are wonderful ways of doing that now. It's quite easy and it's quite affordable.
There are digital ways of doing it.
Yes, you can. Well, this book is also, Susan's book exists as a PDF. Uh-huh. So anyone, you know, you can email that to anyone and they can see it. My husband, who was 20 years older and a terrific storyteller, he was a lifelong storyteller, and he had wonderful stories, and he had a wonderful varied life living overseas and all kinds of adventures in Africa, Puerto Rico. He became a translator of Italian and Spanish. And he and I were compiling some of these memories as he was getting older. And then we hadn't finished. We were doing short sections so that we could do as much as possible. And after he died, I pulled it all together as well as I could and threaded through things where there were holes in the narrative. And I put together this history for friends, family, community. And so that was very similar to what Susan is doing.
Yes. And what the take-home lesson of what we're talking about is that you out there have histories in your family. The little Shamrock Club that was at Seymour the other day, I got them to take a group picture, and that picture is part of their history. Just little things that you can do to put together your information. Sometimes you have so much information that you feel like it must be shoveled out into a dumpster. But in that information, the talent for you is to leave something for your children or grandchildren that they might be able to use if you don't have the talent to put it together yourself. But so that's what we're talking about right now. Uh, So I am pretty convinced that one of the first things you should know is where you came from, where, what, how, and when. Mm. And so Susan's come from Long Island, but you come from the Hudson River, Poughkeepsie,
well,
or somewhere like that.
Massachusetts most of my life. Uh-huh. My daughter is now in Poughkeepsie. Yeah, I grew up in Massachusetts, Vermont, New York, and then spent a little stint in California and then came to Illinois because it was terrifically livable here.
So then, Susan, you're on Long Island, and that had to do with glaciation. And so Long Island, there's a groove down there between you and Connecticut that has something to do with glaciation, and then you have kettles and moraines and things. Tell us a little bit about your farm area and its geology.
Well, I throw around the two words Long Island as if everybody would know what I'm talking about. And somehow or another in the Midwest, there aren't that many people, Cope excepted, but a lot of people wonder if it's in Michigan or somewhere. And I never think to, I mean, I'm beginning to learn after 50 years that I need to say Long Island, New York, because there are other Long Islands on this planet for sure. The one that I know best is the one where I grew up until I was 30. And so anyway, I worked in Manhattan for 10 years and a little less, but not much, nine, not enough to get Social Security. But anyway, I came to Illinois for a year, but the point that Dave is digging at is the sign on the house on Michigan Avenue where I live that says The Kettles. Well, The Kettles, people got all excited and said, is Susan suddenly married? Whose name is Kettle? It's not my name. It's the name that my grandmother, who was another independent lady, and I think I've mentioned the independent ladies of the generation, wanted a place where her older son, who became a America's Cup, well, not exactly, I guess, but anyway, was very interested in transatlantic sailing. And Uncle George, my grandmother wanted Uncle George to be able to see his boat from his window. So she built a house at the Kettles, and the Kettles are named that because the driveway, circular driveway in front of the house that she had built in 1910, which is 100 years younger than the one that I grew up in, where her husband had purchased the farm 5 miles away. Anyway, they were independent characters, Grandpa, whom I never knew. He died in 1920, and Grandmother lived until 1943, so she got to be over 90, but Grandfather did not. Well, anyway, back again to the Kettles. So if you can picture New England as Cope and I can, Connecticut is a southern New England state, south of Boston, which Mother always held over everybody's head, that Connecticut's not a real New England state. It's too near New York. Everybody works in New York. But anyway, a lot of them do and commute to New York. But anyway, so the glacier, and Dave probably can tell if he's looked it up, and I haven't looked it up, but glacial activity that cut out the five Great Lakes here and also the New York Finger Lakes later or earlier, and I'm not sure which, but I'm quite sure they were earlier than the Great Lakes, but I don't know. Anyway, also cut out Long Island, cut it away from New York, from Connecticut. Long Island is about as far as from here to Chicago, and it's about 120, 125 miles long. And when we were children, the one road from the 59th Street Bridge, Queensboro Bridge, as it's been known at various times, to Riverhead, which is 90 miles east of the city, was New York 25A, known locally as Jericho, not Jericho Turnpike, North Hempstead Turnpike. And that was the one road, and that had a lot to do with our how we grew up, because the schools moved and things like that to get off away from the 1930s car traffic that was coming tearing down the hill, which is at least our homestead is at about the sea level of Champaign-Urbana, only a little bit higher.
Cope, you're nearer to the Hudson, or at least your daughter is now, and the Hudson opened up to the west. You had a canals.
Well, I grew up when I lived in New York. I was in Schenectady, which is very close to the Mohawk River, which is parallel to the Erie Canal. So that was my experience. The Hudson, of course, is a major riverway from New York. I don't know how far north it goes.
But it certainly allowed locks to move up and over a range and get into Lake Erie and places like that.
Well, that's the Erie Canal.
Yes.
Yeah.
So these two people have a background in geology, but then comes the settlement patterns. Who settled where and how? And so he goes back to a guy named Jones, I think, and this was very early. He's starting out in 16 something.
Right.
And yeah.
Well, the Jones family. And those of you who may have visited New York and may have wanted to swim may have gone in your experience to something that the subway, New York City subway, gets there now is called Jones Beach. And Jones Beach is the south side of 15 mile wide Long Island. In other words, not a terribly fat island. It's about a total length is 120 or 125 miles, but the the north-south part of the island is interesting in that the glacier cut out Long Island Sound, which is salt water, between Connecticut and the north shore of Long Island, which is heavily treed and wooded, and some of you may know of the airplane crash that was near McElroy, the tennis champion. Well, this is way back. Maybe most of you never heard of McElroy, but anyway. McElroy, I think.
That's okay.
Anyway, whatever. Thanks. Anyway, I'm wandering as usual.
What I'm looking for a little bit is...
Dave is looking for settlement.
Settlement and the agriculture thing.
Well, the Joneses were interested in big houses. And they had... There were two brothers, and they were on the South Shore. And the brother that didn't want to be second fiddle to his brother on the South Shore, where he was building big houses or whatever he was doing, he lived there and had a family. The brother came 15 miles north and found the house that I grew up in. He didn't exactly find it because he found the site, and he then put in an 1810, what do you call them? The stone.
Oh,
it's
limestone?
In wood. Yeah. It's... Cornerstone. There's an 1810 cornerstone in the house that I grew up in. And that was because a member of the Jones family was competing with his 15 mile away brother on the South Shore, which has pine barrens. It's flatter than a pancake. But the North Shore does have elevation of 100 feet where the homestead and Homestead Farm were located, which was the top of a morainic hill or whatever you want to call it. And the kettles, which I didn't explain exactly, but those are kettles and kames are dug out by moving ice. And a kettle hole is a kettle hole, and you can build a driveway around it. And a came is a higher hill that's there. So some of the highest point on Long Island, I think, is 110 feet or something. But it's the North Shore has many, many indentations, whereas the South Shore is flatter than a pancake because it's got the Atlantic Ocean there, and that has a way of wearing things down. But it's also completely different soils than those 15 miles. Is that answering anything?
So, yes, you encountered agriculture, and so that was a settlement pattern.
Well, grandfather felt that it was very unfortunate that people within 30 miles of New York had to get all their food from New York when there were no farms in Nassau County. There were just big houses. And out farther east, it's like New England because they were farther from New York, and they have smaller houses and they have wonderful grape farms. And if you're old enough, you may have eaten Long Island duckling and Long Island potatoes, which were not from grandfather's farm, but they were from Long Island.
Settlement pattern was there.
Yeah. And,
so you, John, your brother, worked on this sort of area a lot, and so it goes back into an era where you have horses and you have water that you have to get from a well, so you have to have buildings that are around the spigot that comes from the well. You have to have barns that house hay. You have to have hay fields. And say something about that sort of era. So just putting together the hay. Now, it may be that as a girl, you didn't necessarily participate in this a lot, but tell us how you experienced the agriculture of your era.
Well, I was only 6.5 years younger than John, but as we worked on these pictures that came from John's files, from grandfather's files that had come out of the barn at the Kettles when the Kettles was sold. The Kettles was the name of the place that grandmother had built, but it had a big barn, so a lot of the family history got into the top floor of that barn. Whereas the barn that I'm familiar with, that was fascinating to John, who through a fellow named Dave Monk found out about people who were taking down barns that had become unused and rebuilding them and putting them up in Arizona as houses. And Dave knew about the Vermont barn people who would dismantle a barn and then put it back together again somewhere.
Often in Colorado for ski lodges.
So anyway, Brother John was fascinated when we decided to give to the Society for the Preservation of Long Island Antiquities our barn, which was an L-shaped barn, huge. I mean, it had cows and six stalls for horses, and it had its own bullpen, and my brothers used to climb the fence and taunt the bull, but they didn't go anywhere near into the bullpen, I'll tell you that one. But anyway, so John photographed every single piece of wood that came out of that and labeled his photographs. That's another collection that Cope hasn't seen, but nobody probably will ever see it. It's meticulous work. If anybody's interested in old barns, how this one was put together with, what do you call them in joints?
Wooden pegs.
Wooden pegs, right. Mm-hmm. And wooden ladders and a hay loft and a we used to bounce around in the hayloft, but you had to be careful you didn't get near the hole where the hay came up and things like that. So John loved woodworking. He carved birds and whatnot too, and did a good job with art as well as writing. Writing was not his first love, but he documenting things was his first love, and so.
But the agriculture was various. It was experimental. You were near to a research station.
That was another very strong influence. Some of you know the name of whatever his name is, Nobel Prize winner for the DNA. Watson is a neighbor of ours because he was the head of the Long Island Biological Association, which was an offshoot or a parallel entity when my childhood with the Carnegie Institute. Carnegie and the Long Island Biological were headed by a Yugoslav fellow whose wife was my grade school science teacher. She was a Cornell graduate. She was Russian, and she got her degree at Cornell in engineering, and that was in the 20s, 1920s, not 2020s. Anyway, Mrs. Demeritz was a wonderful teacher, and her husband was the head of both of these units. And sulfa, which was a very important drug in the 40s around world.
Sulfadiazine, sulfur.
That was developed there, and other things before DNA came to light at the Carnegie. So our grade school, public grade school, had the children of scientists who were doing very interesting things, and the families of scientists that I studied ballet with and things like that. And Rachmaninoff came in one day to say hello to the little girls who were doing. And I hid behind Josie because I was scared to death of this person. And he shook all the other little girls' hands and scared the wits out of the Molly Sanderson's mother, who was playing the piano, who stopped playing, of course, when he entered the room. But anyway, it was a very rich childhood. I mean, just fantastically rich. But that I'm getting off.
You're right on ball. You had bees?
Had bees because my oldest brother got fascinated with them, and then John kept up the bees after Pim was killed in World War II at the age of 20. So mother lost a son in war, which she couldn't stand. And the story goes, too, that Dad married mother because mother said, okay, I'll marry you, but it's because I don't want you to go into World War I.
Yes.
So
you had associated people that ran the farm.
Yes, we had
they were extended family.
Well, very much so, because they were the Danish seamen who had come at age 20 or something from Denmark to the U.S. Somehow or other, he managed to sail over and ended up in Syosset, which is a Native American Algonquin term for maybe Little Oyster, because Oyster Bay is more familiar to most people because of Theodore Roosevelt having had his summer home there. But anyway, now where am I going? Extended family help. The Corfinsons were more than family help. They were family, parallel family. And Harry had bees. Harry Corfinson had bees. And he also was on the Laurel Hollow police force. And he did the races at Roosevelt Field. Anyway, a lot of people were going to Roosevelt Field, which is where Lindbergh sailed in and out of. I mean, he flew. But anyway, there's lots of stuff on Long Island going back to the Native Americans and up to up to the Nichols and Taylors and a lot had, of people.
They even had chickens.
We had chickens. We had an array of things on the farm. Squab.
Squab is a pigeon.
Squab is a baby pigeon, and yes. People used to eat them.
Yes.
And that was something sad as far as John was concerned, but the letterhead from Grandfather's farm that got going in 1907 shows squab and where do we have it, Cope?
I was interested that they got the chickens here. And the pigeons together, and sometimes the chicken and the pigeon would feed each other. There was an interaction. There was a human interaction between
the pigeon and the chicken.
The pigeon and the chicken, and both parents, in a way. So the they had cattle. They had dairy cattle. They had beef cattle, and often these cattle were so attuned to their human associations. They were friendly. The cows would come up and nudge you for attention, and so you knew your horse. There's a photograph of the whole family, and Linda the horse is in the photograph. The dog is there. So there's a human element to this, and when you're storytelling, we want to see some of that human element. Cope, you might say something. You might have some human element that we can share. That Walter had been around a lot, and he was very interesting. I would pull some flowers out of the garbage can, and he'd say, "That's a recognizable plant." Mm-hmm. So say how much. How you have to handle your own interaction, whether you're on a school board or whether you're doing this sort of work with publication, how do you handle your own involvement?
You mean my personal involvement in Walter's stories?
Yes. Tell us a little story that lets people know that they can include these sorts of things in their writing.
Well, putting together Walter's stories, he grew up, well, he was born in 1930 in Florida, and the stories of Florida back then, it was very much agricultural, you know, non-tourist. He was in Gainesville, so it was the university town. And his stories were things like how he made money. He was a water boy for the Florida Department of Corrections. He when he was 16, he drove a truck and took water to the chain gangs. And he, what, oh boy, he had so many wild experiences.
He had something to do with milk, I think, in
Africa. Well, he worked for the Borden Foods Company. That was his ticket to get out of a backwoods childhood and experience. When he graduated, well, he went to war in Korea, and so that was his first experience of being overseas, and he fell in love with foreign cultures, and he was going to do anything in the world he could to get out of Florida. So he grabbed his sweetheart and he said, how about moving to New York? And they, I think he was 23 because he finished college a little late because of serving in Korea. They moved to New York, and he just followed his nose, and he found a job working for the Borden Foods Company, which had an international division. And the next thing they knew, they were on a ship to Africa. And they lived in South Africa for, I think, 3 years, had their first son was born in New York, and then one in Africa, one in Puerto Rico, where Walter transferred from Africa to Puerto Rico. But he did a lot of backwoods travel because he was marketing the milk products to villages and tribes.
And there was a question about that milk product because you had to put in water that was sometimes impure.
Well, and it was not a good thing. We know that now. He did not know that then, that you don't sell powdered milk to women who can nurse their own babies with, you know, there's no infection when you use breast milk, but when you
dirty water.
Yeah, and they were told that this was better for their babies, and that is not true. We know that now, but this was in the 50s. And Walter was basically following his heart, and he was a very young man. He became totally disillusioned with the whole thing and left. But back then, it was just a grand adventure, and he got to drive in a Land Rover way in tribal territories and had to take ferries across rivers and had encounters in the bush with various tribes members. They're fascinating stories. Yes. And, you know, but everything of your childhood, what makes you yourself, I think, you know, taking Water the Chain Gang, and what else did he do? He made clam bakes in Maine one summer when he was 16 years old. And all of those things just tell about the wholeness of what makes up a life in a certain era in this country. And that's what is precious to preserve.
Yes, and you may not think you have the history that we're talking about or the opportunity to travel and do things. But in your life, there are things that happen around your territory that could be interesting in a book. Sometimes people don't think they can draw until they start to draw, and then they realize that they can.
Well,
interpret.
Since I retired, I have been working on memoir, and you can say, you know, oh, ho, hum, I'm old now, I'll write the story of my life for my kids and things like that. But the memoir that interests me much more is the sort of quirky things that you do. One of the pieces I'm working on that I love the most is about eighth grade typing class, because that's when I fell in love with the machine of a typewriter and how the letters looked when they landed on a piece of paper, and eventually that led me to being a book designer. And
yes.
I work in Danville Prison through the Education Justice Project on campus, and I work with a group of men who have mostly been in prison for 10, 20, 30 years, but they write stories of their childhoods that are absolutely fascinating. And, you know, just learning about what it is that goes to make up a person. You know, you hope you're not going to spend a chunk of time in prison, but they'll get out, and they're learning that writing is a powerful skill.
Yes.
And so learning how to tell stories. Well, that's what I love most about WEFT, was interviewing people and hearing their stories. Because when you put a microphone in front of somebody, they want to tell their story. And that's a...
Not always. They come... they bow at the knees... when you ask them first, but then once you find out that they're talking about concrete and they know about concrete, they open up and you can hardly stop the flow of energy. So if you're a little timid out there about writing about your past and your future, then try doing something. At least leave a box of something. Like photographs. Don't put them in the attic, which is hot. Don't put them in the basement, which is humid. Put them somewhere where they can go on to your grandchildren. There's one or two things I'm looking at the time here. We've got 20 minutes.
Ten.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about the mechanics of what you do.
In putting a book together?
Yes. What do you need from us, and how can you put it together, and what do you need to tell us what to not do? Like, we don't need to revise the commentary too many times, or...
Well, you have to have a structure. You have to have words written down. You have to have enough that will fill some pages. And it takes some planning. Very often when you start a project like this, you may not know where it's going to lead. You may not know what shape it's going to take. You might start your life story thinking that it's going to be about dairy farming and finding out that it's really going to be about loving birds. So you start writing and you find out where the strength is in your stories and what interests other people.
So your talent is to pull that out of people to some extent.
Well, I don't usually start at that point with helping people shape their stories. I usually pick it up when they have a manuscript and they want it printed. They want a printed book.
So people come to you rather prepared to do this.
Well, my expertise is in book production. I love writing, but that's not what I have to teach. And usually with books, you kind of start with what form you want it to take. And there are so many companies out there now that will help you produce a digital book. And they have templates. They make it very easy for you to insert your own text and your own photographs. There are many of them. I used Blurb for these two books. I know friends use, I think it's Snapfish. There are many different. Lulu is one. You can sell your books from online, or you can just produce them for your own use. But you have to somehow get words on a page, and if there are illustrations, you have to get those on the page. You have to decide what you want your cover to be like. If you want it to be a photograph, or you can make it hardcover and just cloth, or you know how you want your book to be. You design your book around what the purpose is. If this is a family memoir, you make it comfortable, friendly, easy to hold, easy to read. You try to make the photographs big enough so that you can really see them. You have to struggle with things like having them be high enough resolution if you have scans. There are technical parts about putting together a book.
Yes, you also need to justify the page. You need to have a gutter and a margin.
Well, mostly these book companies set that up for you, so you don't need to know the technicalities of, you know, if the binding is very tight, is the type going to disappear in the gutter? But that's not usually a problem. So that I had to deal with that very much in professional book production, but that's taken care of
So in the past, when we had offset press, you had to order up 2,000 copies if you wanted 2,000 copies or 20 copies, and that was it. Your press was, you had golden rods and you put your photographs in and it was a done deal. You could republish, but it was rather expensive. The advantage here is that you can reproduce digitally.
Well, you can actually print one book at a time. And if you don't want to have 50 of these books sitting in your garage, you can just have the printer hold the electronic files and you can have people order the books online. And the thing is that the price is very reasonable for a paperback 50-page book. You can get that for $6, $8, $10, depending on how many you print. If it's one off, it's more likely to be 10. If you print 100 of them to give to friends and family or sell, you'll get your cost down to about $6 each. And hardcover is more. That's more like 30. I'd just give as a ballpark for an individual hardcover book.
And I think you can sometimes use quotes in this situation. You can put a CD in the back page, which brings perhaps some of the Appalachian music, or what is your particular forte of music?
Well, that's more complicated, and if you want to pull together a CD, you can do anything. That takes expertise. That takes mastering a CD and producing it and making the label, and that's quite a bit of work. But anything is possible on an individual basis, and if that's something you want to do and you don't know how to do it yourself, you can find someone called a book packager who will help you do that.
Going back to the Long Island situation, you're now distributing these books. It was my birthday, and I got a birthday present of a book. So that's not always easy. Give us a comment on how it is to distribute this amongst the relatives.
Well, those are the three words that are a little bit tricky amongst the relatives. The son of Brother John is Russell Williams Taylor. John's middle name is Williams, and that goes back to Moses Williams, and Moses Williams was none other than somebody who was very well endowed because of the triangular trade. In case you don't know what it is, look it up. Anyway, so the Williams was mother's middle name too. So where am I going now? You said about distributing books. Russell is the father of a son, one son only, whose name is Nathaniel, who's made a name for himself in fencing, but also in being early admission to Cornell, which is where Russell got 3 degrees, and they were a little less difficult to pay for. And Russell is now in his, he was born in 1960, so you do the arithmetic. Anyway, he's getting up there. So Russell and his mother, my brother John's widow, Joy Taylor, had a look at this before Cope and I let it go in early August, at which time wedding plans and travel plans and all kinds of things were tearing us in various directions. And Cope said, let's get it done, let's get it done. And I said, yeah, I think we better. And so let go, Susan, because Susan wanted to add this and that. And Cope said, let's not. So anyway, now it's distribution time. Where is it going to go when we get? I decided at the last minute that I wanted 50 more copies because I'd been talking to all my friends here about it. And some of them sounded pretty interested. So we started out with 100 copies, which Sarah, who had encouraged us, who's done these Native American books that are classic, Sarah said 100 is usually kind of basic for a first printing of anything. And I, at the last minute, as Cope was getting on a plane, I said, I think I want 50 more. And so the 50 more came before the 100 came. And they all went to Long Island except for one copy to Cope because she's well known there, and they faxed it over, not faxed it, but whatever they did, UPS or USPS, Postal Service.
Digital.
Whatever it was, it came this way in a cardboard box to Cope's front porch, and I picked it up and got it. Okay, so now we have 150 to distribute, and Susie has already distributed probably 25 or 30 just here and there. And so there, the rest of them are all on Long Island because Russell said he'd do half. So anyway, this is it. And it does cost something to mail a book like this to your friends and fellow people. And I've recently done one for $3 even, and even book post is not that inexpensive. At least I haven't consulted the post office about it.
Well, I think we have to wind up now. But we thank you very much, Susan Taylor, for coming, and Cope Compton.
Thank you.
And,
thank you.
And yes, it's kind of fun to do this if you don't get freaked out by what you want to include. And so this is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WAFT Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial.
Dave on the board. As always, the views and opinions expressed here are solely those of the speakers and no one else. It is moments before noon. You're tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. We are community radio for East Central Illinois. Our pledge drive is officially over. Yay! But we would still love to hear from you. Go ahead and give us a call, 359-9338. We can still take pledges, even if it's not pledge drive. And if you're the shy retiring type, you can go to our website, weft.org, and make your pledge online there. It is now noon. I've talked that long. And it's time now for Shruti Music of India.